This is The Reason Interview with Nick Gillespie. Thanks for listening. I'm leaving New York City for Florida, wrote self-confessed New York supremacist and New York Post columnist Carol Markowitz in a widely circulated article for Fox News. She's not happy about it, but she's also not apologizing. What drove her out of the city she and her husband called home for decades was the arbitrary and capricious treatment of students, including her three young children, who were stuck in public K-12 schools during the pandemic. She's vamoosing because, she says, they took away school during the pandemic and not enough of my fellow New Yorkers cared. I kept looking around at a civilization that doesn't value education. Or worse, she continued, it values it for their own kids in the form of private pods or putting them into open private schools, but won't fight for their less fortunate neighbors to have the same. Markowitz isn't alone. In 2020, some 320,000 people left New York City. Her destination is Florida, where the cost of living is cheaper and the schools and just about everything else have stayed open during much of the past 2 years. Her story is representative of a large swath of refugees leaving big population blue states like New York and California for places like Texas and Florida. For the first time in recorded history, California lost people year over year and a congressional seat. The Florida Department of Highway Safety and Motor Vehicles reported that 51,108 New Yorkers moved to Florida between April 2020 and April 2021. The Sunshine State surpassed New York in population back in 2014, and over the course of the decade between 2010 and 2020, it gained 14.6% in residents, while New York scratched out a gain of just 4.2%, well below U.S. growth of 7.4%. The gap between the two states continues to grow, and Florida now has 21.8 million people, and New York has 19.8 million people in the latest census data. It's ridiculous to live anywhere else other than New York City, Carol Markowitz tells me, but it turns out that the city hates children, and I can't be a part of that anymore. We're going to talk about her escape from New York and a lot more in today's Reason interview. But before we get to that, I want to take a moment to introduce today's advertiser, Inkle.com. If you're like me, keeping up with the news has become a real pain. All the best news sites, with the exception of Reason, are locked behind paywalls. And the free stuff is just clickbait and fake news that nobody should waste time on. So imagine an app where you can get unlocked access to the reliable news sites, an app that filters out fake news and clickbait, but still shows you every story from multiple perspectives to counter bias. Where good news, and I mean positive stories, are highlighted so you don't become despondent, and where journalists dig through news from around the world to find stories you wouldn't normally see. That's what an innovative Australian startup called Inkle, I-N-K-L, has come up with. Inkle.com has signed partnerships with over 100 news sources like The Economist, The Atlantic, and Bloomberg, and they've created a unique system combining journalists and algorithms to create a unique and wonderful best-of-news feed. The service unlocks more than $12,000 of premium news for $100 a year. If you go to Inkle.com/reason now, they're going to give you an additional 25% discount, so you can get a whole year's worth of headache-free news for just $75. That's inkl.com/reason. And now, here's the Reason interview with Carol Markowitz about her personal escape from New York. Carol Markowitz, thanks for talking to Reason.
Thank you for having me. This is great.
So you are a New York Post columnist. You write a lot about a lot of things. You are, you know, a New Yorker through and through. And recently, you wrote a piece for Fox News website saying, I am leaving New York City for Florida. I never thought I would. What happened?
So it's been a long march towards that. I can't say, people keep asking me, like, what was the last straw? And there really wasn't a one last straw. It's been a consistent disregard for the needs of children throughout the entire length of the pandemic that is driving us out. It's literally that. I think also a lot of people just keep saying things to me like, oh, you're doing it for the low taxes in Florida or the warm weather, but they always had low taxes and they always had warm weather.
And as if either of those things are a bad thing, right?
Right. You know?
But, and just to clarify, you're married, you have three children.
Right.
What are their ages?
11, 8, and 6.
Okay. So they're all in school and they were attending, you live in Park Slope in Brooklyn. Yep. They were all attending New York City public
schools. That's right. They've all been in New York City public schools since kindergarten. And we were committed also to the New York City public school system, which in retrospect seems like, you know, a bad commitment, because last year when schools disappeared, I really couldn't believe that public schools could just stop functioning. It was such a big deal. And the worst part was that private schools opened and the public school parents didn't riot. And it's stuff like that that has really has been what motivated us out the door.
Talk about the, you know, what about the school closures? Obviously, you know, that's bad, but you are civic minded enough to, you know, when if there is a, you know, super emergency, you know, we recognize there's going to be disruption. Yeah. What was so bad, both about the day-to-day of schools being closed, so you're dealing with your kids at home, but also the way in which it was done?
So first of all, if you go back to March 2020, I think I was the first person to call for schools to close, which is ironic here. I had been following what was going on with COVID in Asia. I have a brother-in-law in Singapore. I was taking it very, very seriously. In February, I posted a list of things that people should maybe stock up on. And so many people told me that I kept them in toilet paper because of that list. So just to go back to that beginning, I was very afraid. I absolutely thought it was crazy that my husband had stopped going into work, but my kids kept going to school. But of course, we had very little data then. So March, they closed schools finally. April, schools stay closed. I fully understand that schools stay closed through the end of spring 2020. That makes a lot of sense to me. But by April, by May, we're already picking up a lot of data at that point. And there's no denying that COVID just does not affect children in the same way that it affects adults. And to me, that's the moment that we should have start making different decisions based on the data. And when we didn't do that, and when we continued to treat children like disease vectors and like that they might die at any moment, that's really what caused sort of the ongoing problems for me. We could not face the reality that kids were largely safe.
Why do you think, does this just come down to the teachers unions in New York are extremely powerful? New York is the largest school district in the country. It has a huge amount of teachers and administrators. Is it just they were not willing to kind of go back to school?
I think it's a large number of factors. So I don't disregard the fact that New York was the epicenter of COVID-19 in spring 2020. It was a really scary time to be here. Now, we were here throughout that entire length of time, and it was scary. It was scary. You knew people who got COVID. You knew people who got really sick from COVID, and I knew people who died from COVID. And it wasn't like, you know, we're not shrugging it off. It was a big, big deal. And I think that really traumatized New Yorkers. But there's also the element of when things started reopening, you had this, what I call the pajama class, who got to stay home in their sweatpants working from their laptops. And it became a real class divide of like people who had to go to work, the girl at Target who worked the whole time versus the person at home who kept saying, stay home, you know, keep safe, and I'll order stuff from Target online and they'll ship it to me on my Amazon, you know, delivery, and I'll order food and they'll deliver to me. And it's like a whole other class of people. So when we had that class divide, I think that teachers unions pushed for teachers to be on the divide that got to stay home, and it became essential and non-essential, right? And schools became non-essential. And that to me was bananas. And
It's amazing too that throughout all of this, you know, and I also am in New York, that grocery store workers who are also unionized for the most part in New York did not, they did not stay home. You didn't hear stories of, people who stock shelves and work in grocery stores dying in mass numbers.
Right. So, and the thing with schools is that my kids being home was like one of the highlights of the pandemic for me. You know, I often get on Twitter also, I get this like, you just hate your kids, you just want them out of the house. first of all, I work from home. And second of all, I'm a freelancer. So I could write as much as I want. I write a weekly column in the Post, but I could shut everything down and just focus on my kids. What I felt for and what really motivated me to write about the topic again and again and again was that most people were not like me. They could not just stay home and make their own schedule and have, you know, help when they needed it and figure out solutions for their kids however they could. So again, my kids being home, if anything, if I look for one bright spot of the pandemic, it's like, oh, all of us being home together. The fact that schools were closed was a societal problem to me, not a personal one.
What was the impact of learning from home or doing Zoom classes for your kids? You know, there's a lot of discussion and there seems to be a very deep consensus that remote learning, as it's been practiced, you know, just is not very good right now, which is kind of understandable. But what was the impact on your kids and what grades are they in?
Yeah. So I have a sixth grader, a third grader, and a first grader right now. My sixth grader and my third grader are fine. They could literally teach themselves. They are self-motivated. They're extremely outgoing. They're just nerdy and they read a lot and they're self-motivated. My youngest son, he was 4 last year when schools didn't open in September. So he was going to kindergarten as a 4-year-old, already on the young side. He's shyer than his brother and sister are. Through a mask, he is impossible to understand. He will not ask the teacher to repeat anything. And having a Zoom kindergarten experience last year was just a disaster for him. It would have been better to just not have had anything and just have him like look at books sometimes. I mean, it was really like completely ineffective. Zoom kindergarten, you know, like, as I kept saying last year, is not a thing. We should stop pretending it's a thing. And so what really kind of killed me is that it was obvious last year that remote learning was going to be a disaster for the, you know, a lot of kids. And yet it's like now we see these articles like, wow, it turns out Zoom kindergarten maybe didn't work so well. And it's like new information has just been delivered to us that kids cannot learn through a screen. I had this great moment last year where, so again, my then kindergartner, he had a schedule and we would kind of help him get on the Zooms, but you know, I have 3 kids. I have a job. My husband has a job. We were definitely overwhelmed. So at one point, I guess his PE schedule changed. Now PE at home via Zoom is quite a sight anyway. But the PE teacher contacted my older son and said, hey, you know, your little brother keeps joining like the 4th grade PE. And it's like, you know, it was just funny. He didn't even notice that it wasn't like the kids in his class. He was just doing push-ups next to our dining room table. But also, who cares? It's at home PE. Like, who cares if he's doing it with the 4th graders or the kindergartners? It's all the same thing.
Right. When did kids, K through 12 kids in New York City start going back to class? And how did that work? Was that a return to normalcy or was that also kind of disrupted in substantial ways?
So in 2020, in September, school openings were delayed twice. Eventually, my sons went back for hybrid. My daughter's school,
when you say hybrid, could you just
they were on 2 days 1 week and then 3 days the next week, which turns out to be the absolute most best way to catch COVID. You know, hybrid learning is like they established that it was the least safe method. You could have gone to school every single day and have that be safer than hybrid, because when the kids are in school 2 days a week, where are they the other 3 days a week? Like spread out across the city and, you know, contaminating other people. And
also then going, you know, 2 days 1 week, 3 days the next, that also introduces a kind of volatility and scheduling. Right?
Yeah. And you need extra help. You might, you know, hire a babysitter, introducing another person. So it spread COVID more than anything else.
Well, you know, if I may, you said when the school shut down, you know, okay, you're like, okay, you know, I'm a good community member. I'm going along with this. I think it makes sense. When private schools reopened, you mentioned before you talk about this in your writing that you were aghast that New York parents, you know, who are, you know, the honey badgers of parents, right? New Yorkers are tough. They don't put up with bullshit, all of this. They went along like a bunch of sheep. Why do you think that was?
I really don't know. I don't know. it's a mystery to me. I see New Yorkers as such badasses and so tough and just not taking anything from anyone. And when private schools reopened and public schools didn't, I kept thinking, this is the moment. That's it. This is when they stand up, and nobody did. And it was just, I don't know. I saw a side of New Yorkers that really changed me and made me feel like I can't stay here. I can't believe that they don't care about their neighbors. I can't believe that they don't care about like the kids who aren't going to have extra tutoring help. And, you know, all these rich New Yorkers formed pods for their kids and just hired a teacher. And like, what do you think is happening to the 99% of other kids in the city? Because that's not what's going to happen to them.
When they went back to school, how are they, and are they in school full time now?
They are. Yeah.
And how is that going? Cause you know, that's there. Why aren't you saying, cause you got back what you wanted.
So again, my youngest son is the driving force for us because, the masking is really not working out for him. It's also, I think, awful for my other two, as my daughter, who's 11, you know, kind of becomes a preteen. I think a lot of these kids are hiding behind their masks. They don't, you know, they're feeling awkward anyway, and they're just like enjoying having their face covered. But again, my 6-year-old is difficult to understand at the best of times, and so are all his little friends. It's not like he's unique in that. Like they're all like this mumbling, you know, language is not quite there yet. And I see that it's hurting him. I like absolutely see that he's nowhere near where his siblings were at this age. I wrote about how he can't read yet. And like, while, you know, 1 6-year-old not reading is not a tragedy. I know, look behind me. We're in a home of books, right? I'm not worried about him, but it's something that's happening to 6-year-olds all over the country. The reading skills are off a cliff.
They're already not good, according to, you know, most standardized testing. It's rare when children at any grade level are actually at the level of the grade that they're in.
Right, right. That's absolutely true. But for first graders specifically this year, it's called the reading year, first grade. And they keep having these studies where first graders are uniquely positioned to never recover from this. Like so many kids will just never get over it. We got my kid, you know, a tutor. We're going to move him away. We're going to do what we have to do. But I know I'm leaving a city full of first graders who can't read behind.
What were the parents like? And not your neighbors in general, because I could see, if you're living next to people who don't have kids or are single or married or whatever, but they don't have kids, they could be like, oh, well, you know, it's like a long snow day. That might be fun. But what about other parents in your schools? And what did this cut across ideological lines? Like, were parents just scared, or were they livid that their kids were being held out of school?
I met very, very few livid parents, but the ones that are livid, or the ones that were or continue to be livid, the ones who know that we're really destroying childhoods and we're just casually not, you know, not caring about kids in the city, they're ideologically almost entirely on the left and now feel kind of politically homeless. Now, I've always been a conservative, you know, I'm on the right. It was less of a like disaster for me, personally, to be politically adrift. So many people I met are just don't understand anymore. They used to support teachers' unions. They used to think that they were great. And, you know, they can't believe that this is the case. They can't believe that the New York Times, barely touched this, you know, barely argued for schools to open. Like, how could that be? How could the New York Times not realize what's happening to kids in public schools across New York City? Like, isn't that their beat? Like, isn't this exactly the kind of drum they would be beating? But they're not, and they weren't.
And that is, I mean, all of this is presuming you are vaccinated, or your kids, no. If they're age appropriate, are they vaccinated?
My kids are not yet, no.
Okay.
But I mean, I probably will. My daughter's 11. We likely will do it in the near future for her. My sons are so little, and I just don't see any evidence that they need it. And I think countries all over the world are making that same call. And it's not a crazy thing to say. But yeah, I'm vaccinated. I got vaccinated as soon as I could.
So I mean, your discomfort in New York is not stemming from the idea that there are, you know, we live in a city with a vaccine passport where going into an increasing number of places.
Yeah.
And you can be for that or against it, but you believe in vaccines, you're vaccinated. So this isn't a kind of rejection of vaccines as a reality.
But I hate showing my papers when I go to the mm-hmm. diner. Like I think a lot of things are harmed by the idea of show me that you're safe. Mm-hmm.
Why is that though? Can I ask, I'm a libertarian. I've got my own, point of view on all of this, which I think probably corresponds almost perfectly with you in this instance. But why is that such an imposition to you to show that you are vaccinated before you go into a place of business?
Yeah. So it's funny because I think that I would have been okay with this for previous vaccinations, but I don't see the COVID vaccine as that kind of vaccine. Like I believe that the COVID vaccine will help you from getting very sick and dying. Absolutely. But we don't even talk about breakthrough cases anymore because tons of vaccinated people have COVID right now. Tons of vaccinated people are passing COVID. So what are we doing with these vaccine passports? Numbers have gone up since we had the vaccine passports, COVID-19 numbers. It was obvious that it was heading in this direction. Anybody who didn't see the New York spike coming, I don't know what to say to them. I've been predicting this for months. It's followed the exact same line it followed last year. We have almost identical case numbers today as we did exactly a year ago today. But
it is true that if, as you suggested, if you are vaccinated, the chances you might get COVID, but the chances that you are going to be hospitalized or die are negligible. I mean, essentially zero.
Yep.
One of the arguments for a vaccine passport is that it will force people, as they participate in society, it will force them to be vaccinated, thus lowering the overall healthcare burden.
I think forcing people to do something is, that for their own good is a kind of a slippery slope. It's where I do go quite libertarian. I don't like forcing people to do things for their own good. I think you should get vaccinated. Absolutely. And
particularly if I get vaccinated, then I have, and this isn't a kind of, mean individualism, but if I am worried about getting COVID, I can get vaccinated and then I know that I am safe, relatively speaking.
Yep. And there's no exceptions. Like it's not like in other countries, if you had COVID and recovered, you can show that as evidence, let's say in places that have these vaccine passports. In New York, you can't. But what's crazy about that is we do accept that from foreign nationals coming into the US, the State Department does accept previous infection as evidence that you're all good to go. So we accept it from people coming into the country, but not from people already here. Like, what is that? All of this makes no sense. And the thing with the kids, the vaccine mandates, I likely will get my kids vaccinated at some point. I want to see some data showing that they need it or it helps in any way or it's not harmful and all of that. But I don't want to be forced into it by Bill de Blasio. I just find that so.
I don't know why not. I mean, he's at this point, he's been revealed as a better human being than Andrew Cuomo, right?
Well,
also behind a lot of this. Yeah.
I'd say I called that first. I wouldn't say better human being. I would maybe say.
I think we might be able to say a better human being, not necessarily a better politician or policymaker.
Right. But that's the thing. I think he actually was. In some ways, a better policymaker than Cuomo through the pandemic.
Right.
And I think he made some better decisions than Cuomo did. And he was, for all of my hating Bill de Blasio and schools complaints, he wanted to open schools. And Cuomo could have done it like that, but never did.
Before we continue with the Reason interview, I want to introduce you to BetterHelp Online Therapy, one of today's sponsors. Are you feeling stressed out, run down, anxious, short-tempered? If you are, take the time to take care of yourself by going to betterhelp.com/TRI and start talking to a licensed therapist who won't judge you, but will listen and help you with your problems, whatever they are. That's BetterHelp.com/TRI for the Reason interview. BetterHelp is customized online therapy that offers video, phone, and even live chat sessions with your licensed therapist, so you don't have to see anyone on camera if you don't want to. It's more affordable than in-person therapy, and you can start communicating with a therapist in under 48 hours. If you don't like your first therapist, you can switch to another, all without the hassle of driving across town and sitting in a waiting room. I know it's a great service because I used it myself and it really helped me. If you need to talk it out, and these days we all do, go to betterhelp.com/TRI for the Reason interview and get 10% off your first month. And now back to the Reason interview with Carol Markowitz.
As long as we're talking about kind of forced government mandates and things like that, let's talk a little bit about your biography. I always like to, you know, talk about people, where they come from when I interview them. You talk in your writings a lot. You're proud you were raised in New York City. Your husband is a New Yorker, born and bred. You came here from the former Soviet Union, right?
Yeah.
Could you talk a little bit about how you, you know, when you came over and, you know, what your parents were doing there and here and how that influences, broadly speaking, your political outlook?
So my husband's actually also an immigrant, but from Israel. So we both came to New York as small children. I grew up in Brooklyn. He grew up in Queens, very parallel.
How do you get together? I don't know. That's a big problem.
Parallel immigrant stories. Yeah. Well, moving a Queens boy to Brooklyn was the toughest part. My father was a doctor in Russia. My mother was a teacher. My father's from Ukraine. My mother's from Russia. And they were both sent to Turkmenistan for their respective jobs. Basically because they were Jewish, they were sent somewhere. No one wanted to go voluntarily.
Yeah.
And, Jews were forced to go wherever they were told. And so they met there, and they were in that first wave of Jews being allowed out of the Soviet Union. We arrived, my mom and I came in 78, my father came in 77.
Mm-hmm. So you landed in New York, by the way, in about the nadir of New York, you know, at least so far, the nadir of New York history.
Well, I don't know. I mean, nadir has some positive. I don't know. My parents were definitely, when they got here, like a little like, whoa, you know, we think we made the right call, but
where did they move to
Brooklyn, to Flatbush. Okay. I grew up in Flatbush. My father,
and this is the era of, you know, ladies and gentlemen, the Bronx are burning. The son of Sam was still at large in the summer of
78. So my father got here in summer of 77. And he says that was the summer of the blackout, the summer of Sam. You know, crime is out of control. Carter is president. There are definitely a sense of
Turkmenistan looking pretty good.
You know, they could have gone to Canada. They could have gone to Israel. They could have gone to Australia. They had some other sort of possibilities, and they chose America. They loved, you know, the American ethos. And there was definitely a moment of like, this might have been the wrong call. And
did you growing up then? So, you are, you know, mostly a child of the 80s and 90s. Mm-hmm. And, you know, and you and I might disagree about this, you know, the uptick in New York's fortune started before Rudolph Giuliani. But, you know, through the 80s, New York, you know, started climbing. In the 90s, it just took fire. And it's, you know, it's really come back in a way that I don't think anybody in the 70s was expecting. You know, the prevailing consensus was that New York was a dying beast that would give off some heat for maybe decades, but it was over. What was that like, growing up in a city that for the first time really since before World War II was really growing? Right. How did that affect you and your outlook on things?
It was amazing. I loved growing up in New York City. I loved every second of it. I thought so much about New York was amazing. I never wanted to. I pictured my life here. Absolutely. My husband and I got married, we were definitely going to raise our kids New Yorkers. It was absolutely what we were going to do. The 90s were such a cool time in New York because things were getting so better so rapidly. And you had to worry so much less about like getting mugged on the subway or having your stuff stolen, which was pretty common in the 80s. And it was just a great time to live in like a cool free city. I was going to like nightclubs when I was 15. I just, you know, that was in the pre-Bloomberg era, so it was like getting safer, but it was also still fun and cool.
Right.
Kind of a tough balance.
So, you know, one of the reasons you're moving to Florida and you're moving to southeastern Florida to a suburban area, You went down, you and your family moved to mm-hmm. Florida for 5 months during yep. the pandemic. Mm-hmm. Can you talk about when you left? Where were you? And, you know, how did you find that experience? Because, you know, one of the things that you're replicating for me is my parents were New Yorkers and they left New York City in basically in 1967 to the greener pastures of New Jersey, something that they never, ever would have thought that they were going to do until shortly before they did it. So right. I'm hearing, and I was looking at data between April of 2019 and April of 2021, something like 105,000 New Yorkers moved to Florida. So you're yeah. part of a new migration right. out of the city to a particular place.
That number seems low to me. It's crazy. Yeah. Because after I announced that we're moving to Florida, I got dozens of emails and messages from people saying, I also am a lifelong New Yorker. We're also considering the Florida move. And yeah. so I've heard from so many people.
So what was it like? When did you move there? Yeah. And, you know, what were your first impressions? And then, you know, were those good or bad? Because Florida yeah. man, you know, Florida man and Florida woman, this is like, you could have gotten off the plane and you would have, you know, seen two meth addicts eating the skin off an alligator's face because they're coked, you know, they're right, drugged right. out or something, but you, yeah. it seemed to have a good, good impact on you.
Yeah. So last fall, it all again ties back to schools and kids. So last fall, schools finally open after two delays in September. In November, the numbers start to climb just like they did this year. But de Blasio had apparently negotiated a deal with the teachers unions that when the testing number, the testing metric in New York City became 3% positive, they would close schools. That number makes no sense, like at all whatsoever. Even at the best of times, you know, recently we haven't had 3% positive testing. What that number meant was that 97 healthy people had to take COVID tests for every 100 people taking the test, which right. is bananas. It's really yeah. crazy.
Especially because people who are sick or have been in contact with are more likely to take the test.
Well, yeah. So you're counting yeah. on 97 healthy people lining up to take a COVID test. It wasn't like it is now. You couldn't get like in drugstores a test. It wasn't quite as easy. So they closed schools and I am just livid. I can't even believe that we're going through this again. I can't believe we closed over such a ridiculous metric. I would have been like, if it was like, okay, look, we've hit 10% positive rate, or 3% positive rate based on population. Like, okay, that's one thing, but of testing. So I am just beside myself. And I'm like, that's it. Why do I keep talking about this? And I have to just do this. So I start looking up good public schools in Florida. And at the time I had three elementary school kids. Now my daughter's in middle school. I find this school in an area I've never heard of called Palm Beach Gardens. The school is called Marsh Point. I'm like looking at the website, just checking out like their scores and stuff, looking at reviews. People seem to love it. I email the principal just to say, hey, we're thinking of moving down to your, you know, area. She responds right away with like a friendly email of like, I ask her, do you have space for my kids in these classes? And she's like, of course we have space. We're a public school. It's like, I'm like, oh, in New York City, your local public school could totally say they don't have space for you. So, you know, my kids, we end up finding a school, an apartment in that zone. We live in a 2-bedroom. My kids all share one bed. I mean, we really like make it happen. And the kids go to the school there and it's incredible. It is normal. They were still masking, but now they're not. But it was so great. And Palm Beach Gardens was like the sanity we needed. It was my first time living anywhere kind of suburban. It was a little bit of an adjustment. Delivery Chinese food that takes like 12 minutes from the time you order in Brooklyn to them ringing your doorbell takes like 45 minutes over there. And it's not very good. They really need to work on their Chinese food. But other than that, we found it to be sane and beautiful and really just a kid-focused place, which is what we felt like we needed.
So how much of your experience, though, is, you know, obviously COVID, you know, kind of lit a fire under all of this. But on a certain level, I wonder if what you're actually experiencing is what a lot of New Yorkers or a lot of city people feel when they have kids and you can be doing well, you know, unless you're like, you know, Elon Musk or, you know, super wealthy, it gets tough when you're in a city. You want more space. You want, you know, kind of schooling and extracurricular activities to be a little bit more robust and easy to get to and from. How much of your experience is really just that of parents, you know, at middle age with some options with kids in school? Not that that's a bad thing. I'm just saying, but maybe you're taking it out on.
No, I was saying he hated the middle age part, you know, yes, you're right. It absolutely could be something like that. I appreciated very much how easy life was in Palm Beach Gardens, how you just pull into their soccer game and there's a parking spot and et cetera. But in March 2020, we had just completed our dream house in Brooklyn. We had renovated a house over 2 years. We lived in 700 square feet to make that happen. So like, while we have enough money to own a house in Brooklyn, we do not have enough money to own a house in Brooklyn and rent like a big apartment. So we had a 2-bedroom, 700 square foot apartment where the five of us lived for, you know, 2 years to renovate our dream house. I picked every hinge, every paint color, every, you know, anything that you can imagine. And then we, you know, put it on the market last week. So we were absolutely setting up to live in New York City forever. We were going to stay in Brooklyn until the kids went to college, and then we were going to retire to Manhattan. And that was the plan. I know it gets hard with kids, but we were fully committed to all the difficulty that came with New York until
did the New York, you know, I want to say, did the school, like the local school district or anything, you know, schools always say that they want, you know, engaged, committed parents, which, you know, I both kind of understand. And it's always kind of like, you know, but, you know, you're supposed to be doing the teaching, like we're paying the taxes. But did anybody in the kind of New York City school system, even on a, you know, just a personal level, say anything to you to try and keep you here? Or was there any, you know, was there any way that the city reached out to you to say, hey, why don't you stay?
No. Okay. No, I'm pretty sure they're happy that I'm not staying. I am.
Oh, your classmates' parents said,
Look, my kids' schools are generally nice, happy places where I don't have a lot of complaints. Like a lot of the things that people are leaving over, like, I mean, just, you know, I know like wokeness is a real big problem in schools right now, but my kids go to public school in Park Slope, my sons, and it really hasn't been woke. I mean, other than like, you know, the occasional use of Latinx, it has not been
there. And that's amazing because Park Slope is one of the, you know, super fun sites of wokeness, right?
Yeah. And then my daughter goes to a school that's very heavily immigrant, and they just don't have time for any of that stuff. They're like, no, we're learning math and science and we're not interested in your critical race theory. So it's things that I know are pushing people out are not part of my equation yet. Yeah. Maybe they would be down the road, you know?
You know, now it's interesting because I've, again, looking at the last decade, according to the census, the New York State grew by 4.2%. The nation grew by 7.4% in terms of population, but Florida grew by 14.6%. In writing about your move to Florida and your experiences there, you talk about a lot of different factors, beginning with the governor, Ron DeSantis. And you are at pains to say you're not moving there because Ron DeSantis is in charge.
You can't that move would be for fun. One politician, right?
Yeah, no, absolutely. But what is it about DeSantis that you find, you know, powerful? I mean, because he's an emerging national figure. He seems to be, you know, poised to conceivably become the Republican nominee for president in 2024. And, you know, he's attacked by a lot of people on the left and by some never Trumpers on the right. But what do you like about DeSantis? How has he been governing Florida in a way that you're like, I want to be on his team?
Right. So the COVID measures is the beginning of that story for me. It's he did things that were considered impossible. In September of 2020, when he opened Florida, that was considered completely, you know, just something that wasn't done. And he did it so publicly and so forcefully and just like, no, we are never closing businesses ever again. And it worked. People can point to, let's say, Florida spike last summer, but that spike did not happen because you opened businesses in September of 2020, which is what they expected to happen. We're going to have spikes and we're going to have times of low COVID numbers, but I think COVID is here forever and it's going to be part of our calculations going forward. I interviewed him in spring of 21 when we were living there, and his prioritizing of kids and of schools was so big to me. Little things like, he was like, schools cannot close. You cannot have a county that's like, oh, we're having high numbers, we're closing, like schools. No, schools stay open no matter what. And it's crazy because it's considered a right wingy thing to keep schools open now, but all of Europe kept schools open through their worst spikes. They might close like a day or, you know, maybe a few days here and there, but they did not ever close schools for like months at a time or years, the way we did here. So I don't see why it's like a right or left thing. It was like schools were a priority, kids were a priority, and he decided to treat them like that. I also think he sets the standard for the state. I met so many leftists and liberals in Florida who are like, maybe don't like him on a range of things, but they think he did an amazing job on COVID. They think like, they're like bar owners or they're, various business owners, or they're just parents whose schools stayed open. And they think that his COVID sanity is something that they really like. And they might not even vote for him. I don't know, yeah. But it was like, I met people who in New York would just be at home locked up in their house. And yet in Florida, because of his example, they were out and living their lives.
Right. And part of it, and you talk about it in various articles, you know, some of this is about outdoor stuff. Like, we're not even talking about whether or not, you know, if you're working in a coal mine with somebody, yeah, maybe you should all be wearing masks, but that it was in New York City versus Florida, people outside masking when, you know, even if they're walking down the street by themselves. So right. There seems to be a different attitude in Florida and a kind of recognition of some mm-hmm. kind of reality that, you know, you're pretty safe in general, but especially if you're outdoors.
Right. So my kids are still forced into masks outdoors in New York City during recess. Mm-hmm. Right now they're all eating lunch outdoors still because we're having sort of a nicer weather. It's like in the mm-hmm. 50s today in New York. So they're eating lunch outside on the ground. And then as soon as they're done with their 20-minute lunch, they have to put their mask back on. They wear it throughout the entire day, including again, outside. Last year when we lived in Florida for those months, they already weren't wearing masks outside during recess. It was understood that being outside was somewhere you didn't have to mask. I don't know when New York City schools will ever lift that. It's like, if they haven't lifted it yet, every time, you know, they move to lift anything, we have a new spike and they can't do right. it.
What else do you like about Florida? What else is good about Florida? Because Ron DeSantis is, as you pointed out, he's not going to be there forever and he's not the sole reason. But what else?
For us, you know, we're Jewish. We wanted to be somewhere with other Jews. I'm also a big ocean person. So ocean was important to me. Like, we didn't really consider the West Coast because I need to be on the ocean. And every time people in Texas are like, oh, look at Texas. And like, as soon mm-hmm. as you guys import an ocean, like, I'll consider.
But well, there is the Gulf of Mexico. It's not quite not an ocean. I know that. I know that. Trust me.
So, I like Florida a lot. Mm-hmm. I admittedly have not spent a summer there yet, so we'll see how that goes. I just found their lifestyle to be very sane. And again, what's really funny is that before COVID, I used to kind of write, I think I've written more than once on how you shouldn't live your life for your kids. Like, you know, yeah, like you should absolutely care for your kids and treat them well and et cetera. But like, you have to have your own life. You can't live for your kids. But I feel like I have to protect them now. And I feel like they have to be the first priority. And I have to like save them from this insanity.
Do you, and again, this is, I don't mean to project my past onto your present and future, but, you know, I'm thinking of when my cousins, many of whom lived in Brooklyn, would come to visit us in New Jersey. It was 50 miles away. It was an hour on the train or, you know, and we were living in a house where they were in five kids in a two bedroom apartment and on Eastern Parkway in the nadir of New York City. And we had, my parents were not at all wealthy, but we had a house where we each had our own bedroom. You had a car and a garage, and you could leave the car unlocked. And sometimes my parents, because they were New Yorkers, they would make us get up in the middle of the night to go outside and lock the car because they had forgotten to lock it.
Yeah.
And things like that. But you know, part of it is there is an intense parochialism among New Yorkers that there is no place else worth living. And then when you go outside and you see, you know what, like in Florida, maybe the Chinese food isn't that good, but it's there. And then they have other things that are better, or you learn how to cook your own and you can get all of the same other stuff now, certainly now more than 50 years ago.
Yeah.
You know, is there any way that New York ultimately competes with that, whether it's New York City? And you know, I've lived in upstate New York as well. And, you know, upstate New York is like East Germany. It's not coming back. So, you know, is it just over for places like New York?
I thought upstate New York was booming right now.
Yeah, no. It was for 15 minutes when a bunch of scared Manhattanites moved to, you know, north of Dutchess County or something.
Right.
But they're all trying to come back. Yeah. They'll probably buy your house at a very good price.
So, you know, I've always actually also seen New York as quite parochial, but I didn't care. Yeah. I liked it.
Of course. It is the greatest city in the world. Like, why would anybody live anywhere else
except
when you see what else is out there?
Right. It's ridiculous to live anywhere else. But it turns out that the city hates children and I can't be a part of that anymore. Like, I'm already thinking ahead to like when we visit what restaurants we're going to want to go to when we're here. I don't pretend that I like hate it. I hate New York now. I'm not like a New York hater. I root for New York. I want the best for the city. And I'm looking forward to visiting and eating at Minetta Tavern and like, you know, Rosella and just all the restaurants that like are amazing and make the city what it is. But you know, the fact that my kids can't eat at any of those restaurants right now is sort of on my mind. And I have to kind of parse what matters right now. And you know, sadly, it's not my restaurant scene.
Well, let's, it's never good to bring kids to a good restaurant, right? Because they don't appreciate it. So
I don't know. I feel like New York kids do appreciate it.
This is what, you know, Macaroni Grill and, you know, TGI Fridays and stuff like that.
Yeah, my kids have never been to any of that.
Yeah. Golden Corral. You'll learn about all of the buffets that are available in the real America. Mm-hmm. If there is one thing, and why don't we end on this? If there's one thing that you might say to the political leaders, as well as kind of the civic leaders and the educational leaders of New York, you know, what you seem to be describing is that, you recognize, and again, your writing is really rich because you obviously love New York, but you're not an idiot about it. You recognize that New York is a tough place to live. It's not for everybody. And cities kind of make, you know, any region makes a deal with the people who live there. It's like, you know, you pay us so much in taxes, so much in frustration, maybe so much in crime or bad services.
Yeah.
Because it's worth being here.
Right.
And obviously for you, that calculus has really shifted to where it's like New York's not worth it anymore. Mm-hmm. If you could say to the leaders of the city and of other places like this, because we're seeing the same thing happening in places like San Francisco and to a degree, LA and California more broadly, you know, what do they need to be mindful of? What would you say? Hey, if you want to have a chance at me coming back or keeping people like me from leaving in the first place, what should be at the front of their mind?
I know this is an overused phrase, but follow the science. Like, we know what to do. We know what the data is. We know what the numbers are. We know how to treat different segments of the population who are more at risk or less at risk. We have to stop treating kids like they have multiple childhoods that we could ruin this one, but there's another one coming right after that. You know, kids are never going to get these years back. We can't just pretend it doesn't matter that we intensely mask the least risky segment of the population. I think we need to face some sanity, and it starts with, you know, believing in science, trusting the science, looking at the data, looking at numbers, and really making decisions based in something. It makes no sense the things that we do, like we just brought back the masking from the door of the restaurant to your seat. Like, that's stupid. Like, let's not do that
anymore. No, that's the last thing holding back total chaos, right?
Right. But like that kind of stuff makes people distrust the system. It makes people feel crazy. It just, if you want to have sanity back, take sane measures based in actual science, and that will go a long way to making people trust, you know, science in general, and making them kind of see that it's not just chaos out there, and it's not just leadership doing whatever they feel like doing when they woke up this morning, and it's actually like has some basis in reality.
All right, we're going to leave it there. We've been talking with Carol Markowitz, who's a columnist at the New York Post and writes just about everywhere else, and now a future Floridian. Carol, thanks for talking.
Thank you, Nick.
This has been The Reason Interview with Nick Gillespie. Please subscribe to this podcast at Apple, Google, Spotify, SoundCloud, wherever you get your podcasts. Or make it easy on yourself and go to reason.com/podcasts and sign up there. Thanks for listening.